Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Effective Assistance of Counsel Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 19th, 2017, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Weaver v. Massachusetts. Cantel Myrone Weaver was convicted of first-degree murder for the 2003 shooting of Jermaine Rucker. In 2011, Weaver filed a motion for a new trial, claiming that he was denied effective assistance of counsel. A court officer had closed the court, Weaver's family, and other members of the public during jury selection because of overcrowding. Weaver claimed that this closure violated his Sixth Amendment right to a public trial, and his counsel had failed to object to the closure. The Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts affirmed Weaver's conviction on direct appeal and declined to grant relief on his Sixth Amendment claim. The question before the Supreme Court is whether a defendant asserting ineffective assistance that results in a structural error must, in addition to demonstrating deficient performance, show that he was prejudiced by counsel's ineffectiveness, as held by four circuits and five state courts of last resort, or whether prejudice is presumed in such cases, as held by four other circuits and two state high courts. To discuss the case, we have Peter M. Thompson, who is special counsel at Stone Pigman Walther Whitman, LLC. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Thompson.
This case, Weaver versus Massachusetts, stems from a first-degree murder prosecution. The defendant, by the name of Kentel Weaver, who was only 16 years old at the time, shot and killed another young man by the name of Jermaine Rucker. The weight of the evidence at trial was apparently overwhelming. Weaver even confessed to the killing. Prior to trial, during jury selection, however, because of overcrowding in the courtroom by the jury panel, The trial judge shut the doors and refused to allow the defendant's mother and family members into the courtroom during jury selection. The next morning, jury selection continued. Weaver's family was once again excluded. But later on in the day, after the jury was seated, the defendant's family and other members of the public were allowed into the courtroom. Ultimately, Weaver was convicted of first-degree murder. Years later, in 2011, Weaver filed for a new trial claiming that he had been denied effective assistance of counsel because his attorney had failed to object to the closure of the courtroom during jury impanelment in violation of Weaver's Sixth Amendment right to a public trial. The trial court denied the motion, and on appeal, the Supreme Court of Massachusetts affirmed. Although the Massachusetts court agreed that Weaver's Sixth Amendment right to public trial had been violated, and also agreed that his defense counsel had acted objectively unreasonable in failing to object to the closure, the Massachusetts Supreme Court denied relief to Weaver under the Strickland ineffective assistance of counsel analysis because simply Weaver was unable to prove that he had been prejudiced by his counsel's deficient performance. In any event, the Massachusetts Supreme Court held that although a Sixth Amendment violation typically constitutes a structural error, which is automatically presumed, by the way, in which the court admitted to be prejudicial, where such an error stems from an alleged ineffective assistance of counsel claim, a defendant nevertheless must still show that he was actually prejudiced. So the issue before the U.S. Supreme Court in this case is whether an ineffective assistance of counsel claim requires a showing of prejudice where the underlying deficient performance by counsel is based on a failure to object to what amounts to be clearly a structural error in violation of the Sixth Amendment. So, to be clear, the issue before the court is whether there was a right to counsel violation, and we know under Strickland, prejudice must be shown. Now, before I go on, I would like to touch briefly on the two competing legal doctrines, which are really at the heart of this case, and which some of the justices, at least, I think, are looking for a way to possibly harmonize or at least reconcile through this decision. The first doctrine is set forth by the Strickland case with regard to making out an effective assistance of counsel claim. Under Strickland, the defendant must first show that the counsel's performance was so deficient that it fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. Strickland's second prong requires that a defendant then prove that a reasonable probability exists that but for counsel's deficient performance, the results of the trial would have been different. So simply put, the defendant under Strickland must prove that his attorney's performance was objectively deficient and that deficiency resulted in actual prejudice. Now, the competing doctrine concerns structural errors, or structural errors are in the proceeding itself. Structural errors affect the actual framework within which a trial is conducted, and for that reason, these kind of errors implicate the fundamental fairness of a proceeding itself. So structural errors normally require automatic reversal of the conviction without any regard to the effect of the error. Of particular relevance in this case, a violation of a defendant's constitutional right to a public trial when reviewed on a direct appeal is a structural error that is reversible regardless of whether a defendant can prove prejudice. And the Supreme Court has already ruled that denying public access during the jury impanelment process is a structural error. On the question of whether Weaver must show prejudice with regard to his ineffective assistance of counsel claim here, based on a failure to object to a structural error, the justices really seem to be divided. During argument, every justice, with the exception of Justice Thomas, engaged either government counsel or Weaver's counsel during argument. I should add, joining an oral argument was an attorney from the U.S. Solicitor General's Office of the Department of Justice, which had previously filed an amicus brief supporting the position taken by Massachusetts in the case. So, turning specifically to oral argument, at the outset, Justice Ginsburg suggested to Weaver's counsel that there are different kinds of structural errors. And this theme of, you know, different kinds of structural errors and how to treat them was later echoed by Justice Sotomayor, who indicated that the court might actually examine ways to distinguish between structural errors, specifically the quality of the errors, which would allow the court to decide if the error affected fundamental fairness or the fundamental fairness of the trial. So as if Justice Sotomayor was searching for a standard to bring the two competing doctrines together, she used by analogy the plain error standard applicable on direct appeal. Now, to put this in context, under the prior court's decision in Olano, to establish plain error, a defendant must first show that the court or the district court committed error. The second prong requires that the error be plain. The third prong, that the plain error affected the defendant's substantial rights. And under the fourth prong, which became subject to a lot of talk and debate during oral argument, but the fourth prong of Olano is that a reviewing court is allowed to correct the error if allowing the error to stand would seriously affect the fairness, integrity, or the public reputation of judicial proceedings. So this is called the fourth prong. So Justice Sotomayor, in discussing how to distinguish structural errors by the quality of the error, of the quality of the errors, by analogy brought in the plain error standard into oral argument, and she noted that the plain error fourth prong measures the effect of the error on the trial or on the integrity of the proceeding. And in order to do that, she noted, a reviewing court would necessarily have to look at actually what happened in the case. Now, Justices Gorsuch and Breyer seem to weigh in somewhat agreeingly on this same line of thought. I think particularly Justice Breyer, who seemed to suggest that the two competing doctrines, which again are ineffective assistance, the Strickland standard, and the structural error doctrine, that these two competing doctrines be, in his words, harmonized. By applying the plain error standard, or the fourth prong under the plain error standard, for counsel errors which are unpreserved during the actual trial. Justice Breyer seemed to be concerned with how to distinguish those errors, meaning the fourth prong, the plain error standard affecting the fairness and integrity of the trial, with those areas in which such an effect cannot be measured at all, much less proven. It seemed that Justice Breyer possibly was suggesting that there may be a way to marry or to reconcile the two doctrines, and Justices Sotomayor and Gorsuch seemed to be in line with Justice Breyer's thinking. So to carry that a bit further, for example, Justice Breyer suggested the idea that maybe the court could distinguish between, distinguish between the two types of structural errors, requiring proof of prejudice in those areas which seriously affect fundamental fairness, i.e. the fourth prong, and no proof being required of prejudice for those errors that do not. If the court were to take that position, he suggested, that would possibly harmonize the plain error standard with the ineffective assistance of counsel doctrine in a collateral proceeding. Likewise, Justice Gorsuch's line of questions suggested that he might be considering whether to defer to the plain error approach, which would require Weaver definitely to meet the fourth prong. More thought-provoking, I think, however, is that Justice Gorsuch questioned whether a structural error even exists in this case, and even suggested that the closure of jury selection might fit into the triviality exception established under prior precedent, which approach would necessarily involve, of course, categorizing the types of structural errors. So Justice Gorsuch's apparent skepticism, I think, was also revealed when he specifically told Weaver's counsel that the failure to preserve a structural error objection at trial does not automatically translate into a win every time. Now, on the other side of the spectrum, Justice Kagan, while first noting that structural errors are presumed to be unfair and free the defendant of any burden whatsoever to prove anything beyond the existence of such an error, emphasized on more than one occasion during argument that the court has said time and again, over and over again in her words, that it is absolutely impossible to know how a structural error affected the proceeding, and that a defendant cannot prove something that is unprovable, or in other words, a defendant cannot prove prejudice with regard to a structural error because it is impossible to prove. Justice Kagan defined the issue before the court, therefore, in this way. Knowing it's impossible to prove, should the court require a defendant to show how a structural error prejudiced him? Being asked to prove the impossible, she said that Weaver was being placed in a Kafkaesque position, having to prove something that the entire court knows that he cannot prove. This inability to prove prejudice for a structural error certainly gave her serious pause. Now, responding to Justice Kagan, Justice Alito staked out somewhat of a different position. He seemed to be persuaded more by the government's argument that Weaver must prove prejudice because the issue facing the court, he emphasized, is ineffective assistance of counsel. So while recognizing that there are trial closures to the public that certainly can affect the outcome of the trial, Justice Alito was interested in how the jury's or how the jury closure in Weaver's case affected his rights. And to that question, Weaver responded during argument, there is no way to know. And this is a position Weaver took throughout the argument. Now, Chief Justice Roberts did not say much during argument, and Justice Kennedy said even less. But notwithstanding, Chief Justice Roberts did speculate on the facts that actually define a closed courtroom. So he suggested that in Weaver's case, jury selection was not closed to the public because the members of the jury panel comprised the public, in his words. But Weaver's counsel, citing Presley versus Georgia, countered that courtroom crowding or overcrowding is no excuse. Justice Sotomayor seemed to weigh in with Weaver's counsel, and she disagreed with Chief Justice Roberts on this point, making a distinction between a member of the public voluntarily appearing and those members of the public being compelled to attend the proceeding. So Justice Sotomayor took the position that the term public means anyone interested in attending the trial, not anyone who is compelled to attend as a potential juror. Returning to Justice Roberts, however, he also expressed his belief that structural errors are certainly not the most grievous type of errors. In expressing this belief, he may actually have tipped his hand in that regard, and even further when he said that the exclusion of the public from voir dire when the courtroom is otherwise full is not high on the list of errors in criminal cases. In any event, Chief Justice Roberts seemed to be leaning towards requiring that prejudice be proved under the Strickland standard, notwithstanding Justice Sotomayor's position that it can never be proved. So where will the court come down on this? I think it's very difficult to predict. Maybe the court will reconcile the triviality exception with the automatic reversal rule, distinguishing the different grades of structural errors, some requiring automatic reversal and others not. Or maybe the court will decide it doesn't have to harmonize the two doctrines at all and hold that failure to object and preserve an error requiring automatic reversal of a conviction is prejudicial per se under Strickland. Whatever the court decides, I think there's better than a 50-50 probability that it's going to make new law with this decision.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.fedsoc.org/multimedia.